following is a recording of the John Sufflett teleconference with American Hospital Association Chicago on Wednesday, November 14, 2018, at 1 o'clock p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we now have our presenters in conference. Participation in this presentation is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law. Please disconnect from the call or log off the webinar if the AHA did not expressly invite your participation. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. During today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions or comments. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question or give a comment. You can also submit questions via the Q&A pod located to the right of today's presentation. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. John Sufflett.
Great. Thanks so much, Brad, and welcome everyone to the AHA Constituency Section's Executive Leadership Webinar Series. Today's program is Managing Workplace Safety and Reducing Workplace Violence. I'm John Sufflett. I'm the Senior Director of the AHA Section for Metro Hospitals. And to review, as part of the series for executive engagement, the AHA is presenting information, case examples, tools that will assist our member organizations make the transition from volume to value in an environment of health reform. Today's program highlights a progressive example of managing workplace safety and reducing workplace violence in hospitals. But as Brad said, and before we begin, please know that if you need to ask a question or if you have a question for our faculty, then you can use that Ask a Question box that appears on your monitor. And I'll be able to respond to you in real time during the program, or we can use those questions during the Q&A session that will be at the end. Violence is a significant public health issue and a great concern to hospitals that are caring for victims of violence. It is also a major concern for those who work in hospitals. In 2013, according to data from the Department of Labor, private sector healthcare workers in inpatient facilities, such as hospitals, experienced workplace violence-related injuries requiring days off from work at an estimated rate at least 5 times higher than the rate for private sector workers overall. This led the GAO to conclude in its 2016 report, workers in healthcare facilities experience substantially higher estimated rates of non-fatal injury due to workplace violence compared to workers overall. The American Hospital Association retained Milliman Research to conduct a study of the financial impact to hospitals and health systems of dealing with all types of violence within their communities and workplaces. The purpose is to illustrate the enormity of violence as a public health problem. And with this report, the AHA and Milliman have made the first estimate of the total financial cost of the effect of violence on U.S. hospitals. And together we project that it is estimated proactive and reactive violence response efforts cost U.S. hospitals and health systems approximately $2.7 billion in 2016. Grady Health System in Atlanta, Georgia stands as one of the largest urban safety net providers in the United States. They recognize rising community and hospital violence and its obligation to keep employees, visitors, and the community safe. And with us today from an organization that has made workplace safety a priority and has a multi-pronged plan to ensure safety and empower staff competence is Dr. Rhonda Scott, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, and Kevin August, Director of Public Safety and a former FBI executive with a background in management, law enforcement, and corporate security. Dr. Scott and Kevin, please share with us your experience at Grady in Atlanta.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to share with the audience what we've been doing to improve workplace safety and also reducing workplace violence here at Grady. This presentation is packed with a lot of information. We wanted to make sure that each participant would have access to the information. And so we will not go over all the details on each slide, but after the presentation, you will have access to our presentations And, of course, if you have any additional questions, Kevin and I would be available to answer them as well. We've also saved some time at the end of the presentation for Q&A. These are the learning objectives that the American Heart Association presented to the participants. So we're going to jump right into our program. This is Grady Health System. We were founded in 1890 and actually opened our doors in 1892. The original hospital you see here on the screen is still actually an active building here on our campus. And we love to show this slide because this is the first Grady ambulance that we had here back in 1896. And, of course, this is our Grady today, downtown Atlanta. In fact, you can see partial skyline in the background. We're licensed for 953 beds. We are the premier level one trauma center in the metro area. We have neighborhood health centers, other specific specialty programs such as stroke, burn, infectious disease. We also manage the largest long-term care facility in the state of Georgia. We see 150,000 people annually through our emergency department, which makes us the fifth largest in the United States. And we're also the primary training site for both Emory School of Medicine and Morehouse School of Medicine. We have our mission, vision, and value statement, but I really wanted to focus on our values that we have drilled down to every employee in the health system, and that is to be patient-centered, to serve others with excellence, do right, do good, but most importantly, to be safe. And as you can see, we take safety very seriously, not only from a patient care perspective, but also from an environmental and workplace perspective as well. Healthcare is the fastest growing sector in the U.S. economy right now, employing about 18 million people. But what may be surprising to most individuals is that nurses and doctors are now graduating into one of the most violent industries in the United States outside of law enforcement. So what is workplace violence? Workplace violence is defined as any physical assault, threatening behavior, or verbal abuse occurring in the work setting. From 2002 to 2003, the rate of serious workplace violence incidents, and what we mean by that, those requiring days off for injury, was more than four times greater in healthcare than in the private industry. And you'll see in the next few slides that the rate of violent incidents are even higher here on our campus. In fact, healthcare accounts for nearly as many serious violent injuries as all other industries combined. And within healthcare, we see it in the non-clinical as well as the clinical setting. According to Brian Warren, who has served as past president of the IHASS, he stated that we needed to do a better job of helping the average healthcare worker, be it clinical or non-clinical, understand what workplace violence is. And that's what we've done here. We've defined it for our staff. We tell them about warning signs. We let them know their role in these types of incidents and also how we can continue to make the workplace a safer place for all. Violence, of course, is becoming a public health issue. We looked at our CrimeCast report, and Grady has a CAP index of 617, meaning that the hospital is located in an area where the crime rate is 6.17 times greater than the national average. Atlanta has an estimated over 7,000 homeless people. We have 2,300 that live permanently on our street. We have more than 300 that live within a three-block radius of our main campus. So therefore, the most significant challenge for us, again, is getting our clinical and non-clinical staff to understand what workplace violence is and how to partner with our public safety department to combat any type of violence. approximately 80% of the healthcare workforce is female. And here are some other stats that we'd like to share with you as well. 75% of all workplace assaults happen in the healthcare setting. 78% of our emergency department physicians report being the target of workplace violence. 100% of our ED nurses surveyed reported verbal assault during the last year. 40% of our psychiatrists have reported physical assault. And violence among our psychiatric aides is almost 70 times higher than the national average. And 61% of our home health care workers report violence annually. So who's responsible for the violence? As you can see on this chart here, 80% of the violence are caused by our patient population. And this is when healthcare workers are being injured from our patients that result in days away from work. Our top incidents so far year to date, as you can see, we've had about 95 assaults, criminal trespassing, disorderly conduct, irate patients, visitors. We've had a suicide on campus, theft, and also the use of force. And so our most popular incident has been our irate patient. And you can see some of the damage that has been caused to the health system because of some of our patients. Here's one of our rooms in our emergency department, as you can see, was just destroyed by one of our patients. The other picture to the right is glass outside of our emergency room that had been broken, and there was another assault we had where an actual brick was thrown through the window in our emergency department. One of our patients was upset because of not receiving the pain medication they felt they were due from our healthcare provider. We also had damage to our vending machines, as you can see. And then the picture on the right shows one of our behavioral health caregivers that actually goes out into the community. And they take care of many of our homeless population and our behavioral health population that are under bridges, out in the community, wherever they can find them. And this is the automobile of one of our employees that had been damaged by one of their patients. So we started in 2015 really putting a lot of effort and attention on improving workplace safety here at Grady. We had our internal audit staff to conduct a risk assessment of our public safety department. And three major things came out of that particular small audit where they thought we needed to conduct an independent, comprehensive risk assessment of public safety. We found that there was a lack of formal, documented process for ensuring the testing and preventive maintenance of our security system. And also, our public safety did not perform periodic reconciliation of items that were placed in their safe. But what we found ultimately is that this was just the tip of the iceberg and ultimately led to a system-wide risk assessment of our entire health system. Also, you can see of these major findings that were completed, that we decided to do the comprehensive risk assessment. That assessment was completed in January 18 of this year, and you're going to hear more about that assessment. And we also found that we needed to hire a systems manager, and they actually helped with the infrastructure and the testing of many of our processes, such as our security system, our panic alarms, our surveillance cameras, and you will see how we improved all of those items as well. And then the last finding was addressed as well through the acquisition of the ARMS CAD system, And this allows our public safety department to automate now the patient valuables and lost valuables function. But again, this was just the tip of the iceberg when our internal audit found errors or found that we could have improvement in these three areas, but we actually expanded and did a deeper dive into workplace safety. So in June of 2015, we hired Kevin August, who was a former FBI senior executive and my partner here today, and you will hear from him shortly. And he began to make modifications in our public safety department, really focusing on deficiencies in staffing and training, and also our operational protocols and technology. He also hired another FBI supervisor special agent that helped improve departmental performance, expand operational capabilities, and to provide strong leadership. We also elicited their help in terms of our security infrastructure and hired another former tech manager with the FBI Atlanta field who brought more than 35 years of experience in terms of managing the technological side of our security. And then our CAD system was purchased. We transitioned our staff from different shifts you'll hear more about in just a moment. And then more importantly, as you can see, the hiring of Lowers and Associates, which was an independent consulting firm, and they came in and did a huge deep dive into our program and giving us feedback on the necessary items that we needed to improve. And so, Kevin, I'm going to introduce him to the group now. And we have, again, made a lot of headway in terms of workplace violence and workplace safety under his leadership. Kevin has 36 years of law enforcement and corporate security experience. You can see he's been with GE Capital, General Electric, and also served as a special assistant agent in charge with the FBI. And Kevin has brought to Grady all of those talents and expertise, and now I'm going to turn it over to Kevin.
Thank you, Dr. Scott, and good afternoon, everybody. I would like to begin by first trying to paint a picture for everybody relative to what I saw when I got here. And let me say this. I had experienced 36 years in law enforcement and corporate security, and I thought I had seen everything there was to see. And then I came to Grady. And then I realized there was more for me to learn. So these are a few things that I discovered shortly after accepting the job. My predecessor had been terminated. An interim director had been in place for 9 months. And after I arrived, I found that he was still part of our staff. There were notable deficiencies in staffing, training, and equipment. Our CEO was receiving complaints via email and phone calls on a weekly basis. And the public safety staff was disgruntled and demoralized. On top of that, we had challenges with confidence in the greater Grady employee environment because they had little confidence that the public safety department could provide the safe and secure work environment that they were seeking. So one of the first things I did was we looked at improving the staff image, both internally inside the public safety department and outside in the larger Grady employee population. And we sought to improve morale within the public safety department as well. One of the things we sought to do was advance the skill level of our officers through targeted hiring and training. I quickly understood that we had a history of hiring applicants with experience in corrections. Based on my knowledge of what happens in jails and prisons, I am fully aware that corrections officers are not generally focused on customer service and satisfaction. So we immediately terminated that type of process for acquiring new talent. We sought to modernize the security infrastructure in the hospital. And one of the things that I thought was critical to our success was being able to take our limited manpower resources and use them in an innovative way to optimize our impact on the campus and throughout the health system. We mandated that our managers become members and participate in professional trade organizations such as the IAHSS and As Is. It gave us the opportunity to basically meet professionals from across the world to understand what the cutting-edge technologies were and to make sure that we were using gold standard practices whenever we deployed new processes and protocols. We started to use the data that we were gathering because we had the computer-aided dispatch system, which for the first time gave us the ability to automate all of our operational functions. We took that data and we analyzed the statistics and we used that to identify emerging trends, to identify developing risks to the hospital, and then we sought to become more predictive and proactive as opposed to being reactive. We also used that data to justify any requests that we had for staffing and resources needs. And then finally, we looked at identifying a security consulting firm that had expertise in healthcare, and our objective was to get them to conduct that comprehensive risk assessment that Dr. Scott has already discussed. When we got the risk assessment, which was completed in January of this year, they looked at several critical areas. The first was leadership effectiveness. They looked at whether or not me and the rest of my staff were being effective at managing our function and being responsive to our customers. They also looked at the crime risk, the area where we are physically located, and took into consideration crime trends, the number of homeless, the type of criminal activity that was occurring inside that region. And that was something that was entered into the equation in terms of what our risks were and what needs that we had to fulfill. They looked at access control, and we'll talk about access control a little bit more, our ability to control our perimeter and then to compartmentalize access within the hospital itself. They looked at staffing, and even though that there are no staffing models to speak of that I'm aware of, I think most hospitals will use square footage to make a determination of how many officers are needed to do the job. I would say that is a woefully inadequate way of determining how many people you need. You need to look at the whole spectrum of issues, the type of issues that you have to address, the number of criminal events, how violent many of the customers and and patients may be, the number of folks that you have on duty has to be right-sized. Otherwise, you will not be able to address your primary responsibility. And then we looked at life safety issues. Ron has already made reference to the significant number of homeless that we have in and around the hospital. We estimate there are about 300 people who live full-time within a three-block radius of our hospital. It is a constant challenge for us. They are quite crafty. They see the hospital as a place where they can come to get the health care that they require often, but also they use it as an opportunity to panhandle, to get food, to come in and brush their teeth, and even take a cowboy bath. So it's always a challenge to find them, to locate them, and then to remove them unless they're here to receive health care. So this is an example of some life safety issues. If you look, there's a vial that was used to smoke some crack. There's evidence of attempts to start a fire inside of one of our bathrooms, and you can see the evidence at the top where the fire alarm system was also scorched. So when we speak of the enterprise-wide risk assessment, in addition to all of the things that we've already discussed, like the CAP index report or access control issues, we have a pretty robust behavioral health unit here. And so they looked at how we interact with the behavioral health unit and how we deal with disruptive patients in that environment. They also took the opportunity to look at whether or not this was the right venue to introduce a canine component in the hospital. And we also looked at lighting and the physical security system, the technology that we use. And then we also took a look at existing policies and procedures and made a determination on whether or not we needed to update or and revise some of the existing policies and procedures already on the books. We also looked, again, at our ability to compartmentalize access within the hospital, especially in sensitive areas that we want to keep secure, and we want to make sure that we can prevent unauthorized access in those areas. And then we also looked at the application of a visitor management system within the hospital. I'm going to skip this slide because it's kind of redundant. I'd like to talk a little bit about the benefits of restricting public access into the hospital. And this is any hospital. This is almost physical security 101. If you cannot control your perimeter and if you cannot compartmentalize access in your facility, then you've already lost the battle. So this is critical that we minimize public access into our hospital, and it's essential to our ability to do our jobs. It allows us to better address our homeless problem, which is significant. And if we use these management systems that are on the market, it helps us to identify our visitors, to know who they are, what their business is in the hospital, where they intend on going. It also allows us to create a watch list, if you will. We can subscribe to a sexual predator list, or we can create our own watch list for habitual offenders, and then ultimately we can eliminate unwanted traffic in sensitive areas. So we got the enterprise-wide comprehensive risk assessment done. That was the easy part. Once we had it completed, a couple of months after its completion, we got all the reports, and that's where the heavy lifting began. So we took the leadership role, public safety did, of really working across all of our functional partners, getting everybody in the same room and basically assigning sponsors, if you will, or champions to address the 74 findings that we thought were most critical to the hospital. And with each finding, we had recommendations. In June of this year, we assigned responsibilities, we established timelines, and many of the mitigation processes also required costs. So we determined what it would cost for us to mitigate many of the issues that we thought were deficient. As of October, we were 53% complete on our findings, and we anticipate that we will complete 100% completion of our mission by the end of January of 2019. So let's talk a little bit about the public safety department and some of the changes that needed to be facilitated in order for us to get out of the basement and out of the doghouse and get to a position within the hospital where we were respected and we could create an environment which our employees believed was safe and secure for them. So, I'm a firm believer if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. I asked all of my managers, I said, well, what's our mission statement? And none of them had an answer. They said, we don't have one. And so what I wanted to do is come up with a mission statement, a roadmap, if you will, that was simple, succinct, and something that we could all adhere to. So we created this mission statement. We wanted to provide security services which enhance and support the goals and objectives of the Grady Health System. That's what we're here for. You know, we don't conduct surgeries, we don't do any clinical activity, but we are absolutely essential in this with the mission statement. And then that was our foundational piece for all the other changes. So here's a picture of my staff. That's me on the upper left. The guy next to me is a retired supervisory special agent from the FBI. I've been knowing him for about 30 years. He had retired for about 6 months. I pulled him out of retirement, and I said, I need your help. I need you to come over here and help me get this organization up and running. And then the gentleman next to him is a homegrown a manager here. He's been here for about 24 years, and he was a great source of information for me in terms of institutional knowledge. And then next to him is a gentleman that was a police officer for about 12 years, and he's been on staff for about 12 years. And he, too, was a person that I leaned on significantly when I first got here. And then next to him was an FBI support employee that had 39 years in the FBI, and I coaxed him into retirement. He retired on a Friday, and he came to work at Grady on a Monday. As you can see, the rest of these folks are all senior folks. I think the most junior person on this list has 12 years in. Okay, staffing and morale guidance. I offer this to you not as this is the only way to get where you need to be, but this is a way that I found was successful for us. Success begins with hiring the right people. I'm a big advocate of garbage in, garbage out. If you hire folks that are not equipped to do the job that you want them to do, you're going to have problems. If you hire people who are equipped to do the job before you hire them and have the capability to expand their knowledge, then you're going to have fewer problems. So that's one of the first things. You want to right-size your workforce, and you can't use that simple matrix of the size of your institution. Square footage is not enough. So you've got to look at all hazards, all issues, because the threats are asymmetrical, and you have to have a staff that's adequately sized to address the concerns and the threats that you face on a daily basis. You want to identify those people who are poor performers. Quite frankly, everybody that I had, with the exception of the guys that I hired, a few months after I got here, were people who had been here and they were legacy employees. Many of them are no longer here. The moment that I found out that they were sluggards, we addressed that immediately. Either they got with the program or we showed them the door, and that is essential. If something is important, then you need to assign somebody responsibility to it. So all of my managers are champions for specific functions and issues that we have to address, and then we hold everyone accountable. And then I'm going to go down a little bit. Compensation must be competitive. If it's not, if you're the lowest paying person or agency in the region, then you're going to lose your talent. And then train, and then train some more. So I'm going to speed up a little bit so we can get everything in here that I want to. Here are a few of the game changers, things that we did that we thought were quite productive and changed the game for us. So we talked about the old way of doing business. We had an 18th century solution for 21st century problems. We used a journal to document everything that we did. That was unacceptable to me. So shortly after my arrival, we got capital funds and we got a computer-aided dispatch system, and that's what we used, and we automated all of our functions. When I got here, all of our officers were paying for their uniforms and their equipment themselves. I found that unacceptable as well. I went to executive management, got the support. We now buy their uniforms and all of their equipment. And you can see by the large smiles on their face, it was a big morale booster for them. Technology had to be upgraded. If you look on the upper left, this is the old analog camera. That particular camera was about 15 years old, and it far exceeded its shelf life. If you look, we have the same location with the new digital camera, high pixel, high resolution, and it makes a big difference. These are some notable operational improvements. When I got here, we had an FTE of 84 with 66 on board average. We now have 97 FTEs, and we average 91 officers on board. We used to work 8-hour shifts that presented all kinds of staffing problems for us. We went to 12-hour shifts. We got more folks on the floor, and we give them more time off so they come back to work rejuvenated. Weapons were old and needed to be replaced. We purchased 30 new weapons. Surveillance systems were antiquated. We've already discussed that. I think within the first 7 months that I was here, we got approval for a $500,000 system upgrade that included 400-plus new cameras throughout the health system. Patrol equipment had reached the end of its life cycle. We purchased new SUVs and golf carts. Radios were inoperable. We got new radios that are all multi-channel digital because communication is absolutely essential to our success. And then we had multiple assaults and other antisocial activity in our emergency room. Now we have three full-time officers, 24/7, 365, and we also have an off-duty police officer posted in there. We saw that that reduced a lot of the antisocial behavior significantly for us. Our video storage capacity used to be 20 days. Now it's up to 45 days. Satisfaction gauge. When I first got here, nobody was satisfied with us, not even us, okay, not even internally. All the stuff that we've done, which includes communication, people are happy, and so is my staff. I want to touch just a little bit on parking garages, visibility, that sort of thing. Parking garages are a place where a lot of bad things can happen. We increased the number of officers in the parking garages. We increased our visibility throughout the campus. One of the things, it's a mantra for me, when somebody steps on our campus, one of the first things I want them to see is one of my officers. And when they leave, it's one of the last things I want them to see. Train. We got professional training going on all the time. It's recurring. The educational piece, we work with internal experts to come in and train with us to help train our staff. And then the networking, we do that nationally, internationally, and we do it locally with our state and local police officers. Here's just a few examples, just by pictures, the traffic control and the parking deck. And we emphasize service with a smile. A little bit more about visibility. We just started a bike patrol. We use golf carts to traverse the campus as well. Our internal surveillance system, and we put about $85,000 just recently in the upgrade of our dispatch center. Here's where we actually do our indoor firearms training. It's state-of-the-art. It's one of the nicest firearm ranges I've seen outside of the FBI, and here's some of our folks training on the Aspaton self-defense. Here's some internal training that we got. And the guy that's standing in the middle with the khakis is a retired FBI agent who used to be the principal firearms instructor and defensive tactics instructor for the Atlanta division of the FBI. I bring him in on a quarterly basis to train our folks and certify them with firearms, and I'm looking to hire him full-time next year. This is some more photos on what we do internally with the firearms training. I want, if they're going to use deadly force, I want them to be able to hit the things that they're aiming at, reduce risk to the hospital. On our wish list, K-9 Patrol, that's me and Dr. Scott and other members of our staff visiting a hospital in Tennessee. We looked at their program, and we thought it would be a viable program here, and we see that happening for us on the horizon. And then this is a picture of me and my systems manager, Craig. This is at one of the ASIAS conferences, and we're sitting in there learning and networking with other security professionals from across the world. More examples of some of the conferences that we've attended. And then the last thing I really want to touch upon is the need for your security folks to engage their cross-functional partners, team with them, and get access. You got to reach out to your leaders first and then have those leaders team up with you and acquiesce to your request so that we can train. And we get out and we train folks on workplace violence. And we want to improve their knowledge and their ability to recognize threats before they manifest themselves. And so we've team with our partners to talk about dealing with risky patients, things that they should look for, things that can help them enhance their awareness and give them greater confidence. We also talk with them about when it's the right time for them to call public safety so that we can insert ourselves before people get in the red zone and then bad things happen. The thing I want to emphasize here is the need for us to be conscious at all times. All too often, we look at the world in a myopic fashion, so we got blinders on and we're only focused on the things that we're hired to do. But we need to be aware all the time, because anytime there's a person in front of you that's suffering from mental illness or under the influence of controlled substances, they can pose a danger to us. And then we also talk about safety tips in social media. That's only growing. Safety tips in the parking lot. And we want our folks to be safe when they're at home or when they're traveling on vacation. So we address that as well. I'm going to turn this over back to Dr. Scott to wrap things up.
As you can see, based upon the information that Kevin has provided, we have definitely hired a leader in the area of workplace safety and making sure that we minimize the amount of issues that we have here on our campus. The expertise that he has brought being with the FBI has just been phenomenal here on our campus. He has also provided education during our leadership sessions for our leaders and to make sure that they're understanding their role in terms of workplace safety as well, and you saw that during his presentation. And as we begin to wrap up and provide an opportunity for some Q&A, I want you to know that we also focus on our staff. Even though we're trying to provide an excellent environment and a safe environment, that when things do happen to our staff, we want to make sure that they know that we care about them as well. So we have several programs here at Grady that we call Taking Care of Our Staff, Caring for Our Clinical Staff Caregivers. We have a very robust workplace violence program. We actually call it We Care. And so if anything happens to our employees, we have a program in terms of immediate peer support, all the way up to sending flowers or cards if they get injured, and also making sure that we put them at the head of the line in terms of receiving care and follow-up care here at Grady. We have educated our staff on the second victim syndrome, and we have initiatives in place to support them as well. We've implemented Schwartz rounds. We've been doing it for the last year, and not only do we provide those rounds where we care for our caregivers on days, but we also provide that for our night shift as well. We have the DAISY Award, the Code Ivan, not Alan, I'm sorry about that misspell, and also staff training, and more training. And as I said before, a lot of peer support for our employees. So when you think about all of this information that we presented to you this afternoon, here are a couple of lessons learned. An executive champion is critical to any workplace violence program. And I say that because all of the things that Kevin shared with you, from new technology to staffing to the tools and equipment for our public safety department to be able to do their job, requires support and resources. And because I've been his executive champion, and Kevin has been very closely aligned with our C-suite, we've been able to provide the things that he needs. Pushback is to be expected, of course, when you're trying to change the work environment. But if you communicate and always lead with the why we're changing things, and that has been very receptive to our employees. Culture change is a must. Train, and retrain. Of course, buy-in is critical. Involve your clinical staff. And then start taking a proactive approach to safety on your campus versus a reactive approach. This is one of my favorite slides, and of course it says courage to do what's right, not necessarily what's popular or what's been done in the past. And so you definitely, and in many cases, we have been risk takers to improve the environment for our employees. At this point in time, I realize that we have given you a lot of information in 47 minutes here. And again, our presentation will be made available for you. And at this time, we will turn it back over to our partners at the AHA to lead us in a Q&A session.
Dr. Scott and Kevin, that was phenomenal, and I say that because I'm looking at probably 24 questions that have come through the Q&A box. You've really engaged our audience, and that's what it's all about. And I want to reassure our audience that to the best of our ability, we'll try to address these questions in the time that remains, but you can also forward them to us when we send you the evaluation for today's program, and we can follow up at a later date. With that said, Dr. Scott and Kevin, I'm going to ask that you be real succinct so that we can get as many of these in as possible. And the first question I'm going to ask comes from Laura. And she basically wants to know how you got executive leadership to support all this. It's a remarkable structure that you have in place, but how does that happen?
Well, I can tell you what my approach has always been. You know, having spent 23 years in the FBI, we document everything. And they told us if you don't document it, it didn't occur and it doesn't exist. I think the challenge for many people who are in my position throughout hospitals in America is that they don't document the need. They don't justify those things that they're requesting. And you have two options when you show an executive manager a risk. They can either accept that risk and do nothing, and then when bad things happen, you know where the fingers are going to be pointed. Or they can understand that there is a risk and do something about it. And so it's incumbent upon the leader of the public safety department to show the executive what the need is for the institution. That's his or her responsibility, and that's why they hire that person based on their expertise. And then it's incumbent upon the receiver of that information to do something about it. And I can tell you, and I'm not saying it because she's standing right next to me, but Dr. Scott has been a tremendous advocate for us. And everything that we've asked her for, she's provided to us and then some. And you need great executive leaders if you want to be successful in this role.
Well, thank you, Kevin. And Dr. Scott not only has her PhD, she also has her RN. And as you can anticipate, there's also questions about how have you collaborated with your nursing leadership? How have you collaborated with your clinical emergency department staff? How have you trained general staff?
So, I'll chime in from my perspective. We've partnered as often as we can with our partners across all of the clinical disciplines. We work very, very closely with behavioral health. As a matter of fact, we are seen as partners in that environment, not just as security. So the expectation is that we function along with the clinicians to give the best care that those patients deserve. When we extend out to the other functions within the hospital, I'm pretty close with the director of the emergency room, the doctor that runs the emergency room. He's been an advocate for security. And whenever we have any challenges, I think many of the challenges are overcome by the personal relationships that you're able to build within the organization. It's pretty hard for people to refuse you any request or any support that you need when they know you, they respect you, and you can document the things that you're seeking.
We also make sure that Kevin is a part of the leadership team, and so he is in constant communication with his teammates and his colleagues. I think also where public safety is positioned in organization has a direct impact on their influence as well. And so although there had been many suggestions of where public safety should report, to me it was very important that Kevin and also his department report to a member in the C-suite, and as he just mentioned, reporting to me as chief operating officer, because it also gives me an opportunity to stay very closely aligned and informed about what's going on. I can share that with other C-suite members, and also we can make things happen in the organization.
Great. Thanks so much. Let me ask a question that has come from several people, and it's regarding Code Ivan. And
Jordan wants to know, Marianne wants to know, there's some others that had asked. Could you quickly explain to folks what Code Ivan is?
Well, it's called Alvin.
Alvin, okay.
Yeah, so Code Ivan, that is terminology that we use in the behavioral health world. And so when there is a patient who may be psychotic, or a patient who is disruptive and is not complying with suggestions, if you will, that are made to them by a clinician, that clinician will then call a Code Ivan. This is something that is articulated verbally, and it's a Code Ivan. And then there are designated members. There may be a psychiatrist, there may be a psychiatric nurse, there may be a security officer, a mental health technician. All of those people will respond. So you will have multiple team members, usually four or five folks will respond. If necessary, more people will respond. Most will do nothing other than show up to provide support to the lead clinician who is trying to get the patient to comply. If the patient fails to comply after they've exhausted all of the tools in their toolbox, then they go green, which means that all hands on deck will put all hands on the patient and secure that patient so that that patient doesn't hurt him or herself or a clinician or another patient.
Great. Thanks so much. That's very helpful. Let's go back to your early part of your presentation, Kevin, and Irene wants to know if you can give us any examples of how you're using manpower innovatively to optimize impact.
Sure. So we're responsible for providing security both at the main campus. We also provide security in many of our neighborhood clinics, not all of them. When I got here, all of our staff was on eight-hour shifts. That was a huge challenge, especially during football season, summer vacation time. There was always a challenge with maintaining enough staff so that you could operate safely. That was a big concern for me. So what I did was I went around to surrounding hospitals, and I looked at what they were doing, and I really would like to thank all of my comrades across the region who were quite selfless in allowing me to come into their hospitals and look at their operation and see what they were doing. The ones that I found that were most successful were those that had converted over to a 12-hour work shift. Now, that doesn't mean that all of my people work that way. I have some people that work eight-hour shifts. I have people that work 10-hour shifts. I have the preponderance of our folks work 12-hour shifts. It really gives them the opportunity to recuperate. They work 12-hour shifts, but they don't work more than 3 days in a row. We work in a four-hour day. That's the Wednesday that everybody has to be here, and we cycle them through 24-hour cycle. And then they come back rested and rejuvenated. If you can't do this job with one-size-fits-all. And then we use an assortment of PRNs and part-time people. Everybody knows that these FTEs are just a body of hours. They're not heads. They're not individual heads. So you can get four people to give you one FTE. You can use two people to give you one FTE, or you can use one person. I choose to use a combination of all of those things to make the limited resources that I have most impactful here.
Great. Thanks so much. There was also a question about how do you encourage reporting of WPV events by staff, and that's from Donna.
Could you repeat that question again?
How do you encourage reporting of WPV events by staff?
Oh, yes. We definitely encourage reporting of any type of event, and not just, again, hands-on physical violence, but even verbal abuse, because that's considered violence as well. So the first thing we had to do was educate our staff. And we actually have an annual competency that all of our staff takes that educates them about workplace violence and their role. In addition to that, we discuss it in our staff meetings. We discuss it in our nursing leadership meetings. And so it is probably part of our culture now that if anything occurs, to report it. And if you recall on that caring for the caregiver slide, we have so many initiatives that are out there to care for our caregivers, then I think that has also helped our employees to know that if anything happens, we definitely want them to report it.
One other thing I'd like to add, we have about a 25 or 30 minute block during our new employee hire seminar where we address, number one, what the public safety department is, and about 15 minutes of that presentation speaks directly to violence in the workplace, what it is, what the employee's role is in that the prevention and the reporting of workplace violence, and we tell them how to report as well. So it's part of the onboarding process, and it's part of our indoctrination throughout the course of the year.
Absolutely.
That's really very helpful. Thank you. We are getting really close to the end of the program and probably only have time for one, maybe two questions. I'm going to share this one with you that comes from Linda. And it's, how do you teach de-escalation, and do you have patient behavior contracts?
Yes, we do teach de-escalation. We do have training for our high-risk areas, for our behavioral health areas, for our emergency department staff as well. And that's anywhere from 2 hours to 8 hours of training that we provide for our staff. And in the past, we've also had train-the-trainer programs where we do extensive training for some employees, and then, of course, they provide that training as well. We'd be more than happy to share that offline, but we do have extensive programs in terms of training. Our programs, which you may have heard of, there are many out there on the market, but we use the PACE program and the CPI program here at Grady.
Great, and that was what Erica and Donette were asking, is what program. So it's the PACE program and the CVI.
CPI, P as in Paul.
CPI, and probably you can Google those and get additional information.
Yes, you can.
Well, Rhonda and Kevin, that was fabulous. We didn't get to all our questions. I'll reiterate with the audience that if you didn't get your question answered, please include it with the evaluations, and we'll try to follow up with you separately offline. Again, we'll be sharing the presentation and an audio replay that will be made available to those who registered. And also, we have a case example that really outlines many of these issues that we developed and that we can also share with you as part of our response to the evaluation. So you can look forward to receiving that. I want to thank our faculty. Rhonda Scott, Dr. Scott is Executive VP and COO at Grady, and Kevin August, who's the Director of Public Safety at Grady. I want to thank my AHA associates, Kate Kane, who's the Assistant Director who produced today's program, and Jamel Ola, who helped coordinate logistics for our program. And we welcome and appreciate your feedback on today's call, and immediately following, you're going to get an email requesting your comments, and your swift reply is appreciated. But that will conclude our call. Best wishes to all. We are adjourned.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's presentation. You may now log off the webinar and disconnect your phone lines.